Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Go really electric with an EV or plug-in hybrid from the Kia e-range.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And Joe at RTE.ie is a simple email. Aoife Lynch. Aoife, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. Thank you for having me on today.
And thank you for telling this very, very difficult story, because a number of weeks ago, a man called Anthony Smith, he's now 44, he is from Rathgillen near Knobber in County Meath. He pleaded guilty to the sexual exploitation of you, Aoife Lynch, on diverse dates in 2014, and sexually assaulting you on a date unknown that year. Now, that's 7 years ago, Aoife. Tell me how you actually got to court and built up the courage, one, to report, because it happened when you were very young, three, are you happy with the outcome? But do you want to take us back to 2014 and how this man came into your life and started grooming you?
Yeah, I was being bullied in school at the time, and mm-hmm. I was sort of vulnerable, and I would have been spending a lot of time in his sister's house. And he would have been there quite frequently, three, okay. 4 times a day. And, we kind of just got talking, and I didn't really think anything of it, because I kind of thought of him as family.
Yeah.
And he stepped in and was like, oh, if anything happens, like with the bullying, let me know, I'll take care of it, and okay. you don't have to worry about it. So, after that, then contact became more frequent over social media. He would text me a lot and things like that. And I think he kind of used that to mm-hmm. isolate me from my friends and my family. And it kind of escalated from there. And
And he was in his 30s, reminding people, when this happened, Aoife, and you were 14 years of age.
I was, yeah. There was quite a big age difference in.
Yeah. Well, he was an adult; you were a minor, to say the least. And you believe he deliberately this issue, saying, "Well, if you're being bullied, come to me." You believe he deliberately spotted that, and he deliberately groomed you, knowing you were in a difficult place personally.
I think so, yeah, because he knew how it was affecting me at that stage, and that I didn't want to talk to my family about it,
yeah.
because I didn't want them to worry. So I kind of feel like he kind of seen that as a gateway.
Yeah. And what was he using? What social media was he using?
It was mostly Snapchat.
Okay.
Which, it's such a huge gateway for predators, because as soon as a message is opened, it's deleted straight away.
Yeah.
So there's
yeah.
no way of going back and seeing what was said and seeing what happened and things like that.
And when did you first start getting, because obviously he was in, you were in his home and he was in your home, but how, because he was a friend of the family, so to speak. But when did you first start getting queasy yourself about it, Aoife?
It was so gradual. I didn't really realise what was going on at the time. And then it was kind of as slowly as things started happening. Like, he texted me like the weekend after my 15th birthday and said that he was in love with me. And that completely threw me. I didn't know what to think of it. I didn't even know what he meant by that, because he was family. And I was like, well, what do you mean? So I didn't even know what to say back to him.
Mm.
And I didn't want it to affect my family, and I didn't want it to affect his family. And
because he had a family, he was married with a family.
Yeah.
Yeah, a large family, yeah.
Yeah, plus I would have been close with him at that time, and he kind of made me feel that it would be absolutely devastating, the effects it would have on him as well.
Mm.
And kind of made me feel like, well, he helped me when I was being bullied, and this is happening now, so I can't really speak out about it when he was the one that helped me. Do you know that kind of way?
Yeah, yeah. And you saw him, he's almost like an uncle in the family.
Yeah, okay. I would have considered his whole family to be my own family.
Yeah. So he tells you at 15 that he loved you, which threw you into a complete maelstrom of, a lot of it sounds like it was worry as well. And he kept up the communication.
Yeah, it was very hard to try and act like nothing was going on and to hide it from my family and even my friends. Because I did have a lot of questions from my friends, like, who are you texting all the time? Why is your phone always getting notifications and things like that? And then I was trying to think of excuses, it's just someone else, or, like, it's a friend. And they'd be like, well, what friend is it? So that kind of added a lot of pressure as well. And then he was telling me, oh, look, nobody can find out about this.
So he was building up this... through this predacious behavior, he was building up this is our secret scenario.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he kind of used the fact that I was close to his family to his advantage and was like, well, think about how it's going to affect them.
Yeah. And when he was in your company, Aoife, and with other adults, how would he behave?
In the beginning, he kind of like, come down to the house and he'd be very chatty with me, and he'd like throw his arm around my shoulder in a casual sort of way, and that kind of happened a lot at the beginning and then more frequent, and then it kind of changed completely to none of that would happen when somebody was around or incidents would happen if he thought that nobody could see him. So it changed kind of dramatically from always being very chatty with me in front of other people to barely talking to me when other people were around and not even saying hello.
But then how often, say, and I can't remember specific days, but on a day where you would meet him in company and he would be distant, would he be texting you and communicating you through other means and communicating with you through other means that same day? Do you follow me?
Yeah. Like if he came down to the house and he was sitting in the kitchen talking to family or whatever, he could be sitting there on his phone texting me in the same room and talking to me that kind of way.
He'd be sitting there in your company with other adults and he'd be texting, but the other adults didn't realise he was texting the child in the room, the young woman and the teenager in the room.
Yeah, I suppose my family just kind of thought that it was normal that I was on my phone a lot because I was a young teenager and I was always talking to my friends and things like that. It wouldn't have been that unusual for me to be on my phone quite a bit.
Yeah, of course, at that age. Yeah, absolutely. But nobody knew that the pinging going back and forward in the room was between the two of you, between him texting you and you replying to him.
No. And he made sure that if we ever had contact on, say, a Messenger on Facebook or over normal text, that if anything was said on his behalf out of the ordinary, he'd make sure that he'd tell me to delete it.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So he kind of knew how to keep it under wraps and how to get away with it, basically.
And then he was convicted of sexually abusing you. And you're very brave in waiving your anonymity here as well. But what age were you when he started that crime?
The grooming kind of began when I was 14 and then the more physical contact started when I was 15.
And what is going through your head when all of this is happening, Aoife?
I was so isolated and I felt really alone and I didn't want to affect anybody else by what was going on. So I tried to just cover it up and deal with it myself. And I didn't want to be the reason, so to say, that he got in trouble for this. I kind of felt like, well, I shouldn't tell anyone because then I might get in trouble for getting him in trouble. Do you know that kind
of
way?
Yeah, of course, absolutely. I know what he was doing. He was grooming you so effectively and so convincingly.
Yeah, I feel like it was very well thought out because there were multiple incidences and it felt like he knew exactly what to do without getting caught, because there was a lot of incidences and nobody had a clue what was going on. And like, if I went back to that situation now and I was one of the adults, I probably wouldn't even realise what was going on, knowing what I know now, because it was so well hidden and so well thought out on his behalf.
And going to to your parents or the Gardaí, what was it? Take me through that process.
So initially I went to the guards when I was 18.
Okay.
And I told them my situation. But I told them that my family didn't know and that I didn't want them to find out.
And is that why you waited until your 18th birthday, Aoife?
Yeah, okay. I kind of figured once I turn 18, I'll be able to make a report by myself without any of my family being notified. So I waited till I was 18. And then when I did go down, I was advised that there was no guarantee that they wouldn't find out or that his family wouldn't find out. So I kind of decided not to take it any further then at that time.
Okay.
And then a few months later, I just couldn't deal with it anymore. The pressure was too much and trying to manage everything that was going on and act like everything was fine. So I just had to tell someone. So I told my mum, my dad and my stepdad, and they were so, so supportive. They have been amazing through this whole process and they advised me then to make a report to Gardaí, which I did then at that stage.
How many years did the abuse go on, Aoife, between the grooming and the sexual abuse?
It's kind of hard to put an exact timeline on it, but from when the grooming began until I had no more contact with him anymore, I'd say it was a year, maybe a bit more.
Okay. So you then went back to the Gardaí?
Yeah, I went back to the Gardaí and appointment was set up for me to go and make a statement to the guards, and I found that very, very difficult to sit in a room in front of a complete stranger and tell them everything that had happened, and especially when it was a few years ago, and saying it to like an authority figure as well, when I didn't even tell anyone else. I didn't tell my mum or dad any of the details that happened. I just told them that I had been abused. So it was very difficult to walk into a Garda station without ever telling anyone about it and then tell a stranger everything that happened.
And did you walk in on your own?
I went into the Garda station on my own, but my mum and dad were outside in the car park.
Okay, well, still you're very... very, very brave. And just to go back, when he started grooming you as he's and this sexual exploitation, how was he trying to make you feel? Was he trying to make you feel protected? Is that was his? Here was this man in his late 30s saying to a 14-year-old girl who's been bullied in school, what was his language? I'll protect you, was it?
I think his kind of attitude was about it. Well, I helped you when you were bullied, so does that not show you that I'd never do anything to hurt you or I'd never put you in harm's way? And if anything happens to you, I'm going to be here to help you and sort everything out for you. So then in my mind, I was like, well, he helped me when I was bullied and he's a part of my family and I know this is wrong and this shouldn't be happening, but what does it mean then when... it's somebody in your family.
How did you break off contact with him? Was that difficult?
My father and his sister, their relationship ended, so I wasn't in that situation.
Okay, he had no reason to visit the house.
Yeah.
Okay, and how did he react on social media when you stopped?
I had initially broken off contact and deleted him off social media, but then there were other accounts that were set up, so that kind of defeated the whole purpose of me deleting the other accounts. But
well, he was setting up other accounts to contact you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
And I kind of just tried to put it out of my mind and kind of act like it wasn't happening, because I was so concerned with how it would affect other people. Yeah. I wasn't really thinking about what was actually going on or how it was affecting me. Like, my whole mindset was like, just make sure that my family don't get affected by this and that his family doesn't find out.
But this is what he was planting in your head all the time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
This was part of his grooming, his behaviour. He was trying to convince you that if you did reveal the consequences, not just for him, but for both your families, would be catastrophic.
Yeah, it was kind of.
And it worked for a while. It did work for a while.
Yeah, it worked for a long time. Even after I had no contact with him anymore, it was still a very, very, very big reason that I didn't tell anyone or report it for so long.
Yeah. So, Aoife, between that time when you walked into the Garda station and court, what was the time frame?
It was almost 4 years.
Okay. And did you see him in the meantime? Did you bump into him, or did he try and contact you in the meantime?
I didn't know.
Right,
I constantly had it in the back of my mind, like, oh, what's going to happen if I do see him, or if I do run into him? Like, what is his reaction going to be? Because the case was being investigated for a while before I knew if he was pleading guilty or not guilty. So during that time, I had no idea how he was taking this and what his reaction was to the whole situation.
And you thought it might come down to his word against yours?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you say, I no longer regard myself as a victim, but as a survivor.
Yeah. I felt like, for myself, I needed to stand up in court and read my victim impact statement out myself and to help other people, because it happens to so many people on a daily basis, and most of these cases don't get reported because they feel like they might not be believed. And I have had a few people come up to me and say, oh, it happened many years ago, so there's not any point in reporting it or telling people about it.
This is what was said to you?
Yeah, other victims have said this to me.
Okay.
And I've had people say, oh, well, what happened to me, it wasn't as bad as it could have been compared to if they had have been raped or physically attacked. And it shouldn't be like that. If something makes you feel uncomfortable, it shouldn't happen. End of. It doesn't matter if it's your best friend, if it's somebody in your family, or if it's a stranger.
It's a crime.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't matter if you don't think it was that bad, or if you feel like, oh, there's no point reporting it, or I can deal with it myself. You still need to talk to somebody. You shouldn't be silenced by your abuser. You deserve to have support around you, whether that's a professional or it's somebody that you trust.
And the effect it's had on you, Aoife?
It has had a huge effect on me. Like, it's never gone away. It's always there in the back of my mind. It's just a matter of trying to figure out what way works for you to deal with it, and taking it day by day. Like, there are some days where I'm in a great mood and it might only cross my mind once or twice.
Yeah.
And then there could be days where it's all I can think about.
Yeah. And you were at a very vulnerable, a very brilliant age for most young men and women and boys and girls in terms of their teenage years and school and enjoying themselves and meeting new people and music and interests. Do you feel that was robbed from you?
Yeah, I feel like all of my childhood teenage years have been taken away by him and just replaced with constant mental, physical and emotional effects. And now I can just try to move on with my life and do what I want without that hanging over me anymore.
And what was it like seeing him in court?
It was very, very hard to see him in court. I was shaking the whole time. I felt like I couldn't breathe. It was, especially after so long and the case taken so long, it kind of felt like that day would never come. And then when it did, it didn't even sink in what was happening. And then when I seen him in court, it was like just everything kind of came back to me. And then I kind of remembered that I'm not the only one that has been affected by sexual abuse. It happens to a lot of people. I need to do this for other people as well as myself.
It's incredible courage and great resources that you can rely on, that reservoir of saying, I have to do this for others. It's incredible.
Yeah, thank you. It needs to be talked about more. Survivors shouldn't have to feel like they can't talk about it because of the effects it will have on other people.
Yeah.
And it kind of gives abusers then a gateway to think, oh, well, I'm going to get away with this. They might not report it. The majority of cases don't get reported. So I think a lot of abusers use that to their advantage.
Yeah. And how long did Anthony Smith wait before he pleaded guilty?
It was about halfway through the investigation and he pled guilty.
Did he have any interaction with you in the court? Did he look at you? Did he apologise? Did he?
We had no interaction in the court. He didn't even look my way once. His barrister did read an apology on his behalf, and personally, I feel that it was very insincere. I feel like it took a lot of strength for me to stand up in a courtroom in front of a lot of people that I didn't know and in front of him and read something so personal. And in return, he wasn't able to stand up himself and apologise to me.
Good point, yeah.
I just feel like it was just something that was said. I feel like there was no meaning behind it.
And the judge said it was a disgusting and devastating breach of trust. And he sentenced Anthony Smith to 5 years in jail with the final 3 years suspended. How did he react at the sentence? Well, more important, how did you react for the sentence?
Initially, I was so grateful that he had got a sentence. But at the same time, it's nothing compared to what I've been through for the last 7 years.
Yeah.
And, the last 7 years of my life has been completely taken over by him. And in return, he's spending 2 years in jail. I just feel like that's not fair.
Yeah. What do you think of the 5 years and the final 3 years suspended? Which means he's 24 months, which means he should get one third. Well, again, this can be different for sexual offences. But he could be out within 2 years.
Exactly. Mm. It's not even that he'll spend a full 2 years in jail. There's every chance that he'll get out before then. And that took a big toll on me, because for me, it literally took every bit of strength I had to go through this process and to be able to talk about it. And in return, he's only getting 2 years, if even. So I feel like there's a lot of work that needs to be done within the justice system, because that's a huge reason that a lot of survivors don't come forward or report it, because they feel like, well, why would I report something so personal and have to relive it for the abuser to get a very lenient sentence?
You mentioned that, just again, I don't dismiss that phrase you use either, because you said it's taken the sentence has taken a very heavy toll.
Yeah.
Okay. You think it's too lenient?
Absolutely. I think that for everything that happened from start to finish and everything in between, like the case I'm worrying about it constantly, I just feel like it's an injustice. And it's also sending the message to other survivors that people like this get lenient sentences.
Well, you got a 5-year sentence, but more of it was suspended than will ever be implemented.
Yeah, that's kind of what threw me a bit as well. Like, he got a 5-year sentence and most of it was suspended.
Yeah, good point. Aoife, you mentioned Snapchat, and I just we got this email. I just want to read it out for the listeners. Given that you mentioned Snapchat, that was the way he was communicating with you. I received the above text from my daughter's school on Friday last. This is the text. It has been brought to our attention that there is a very large group Snapchat circulating between first years aimed at insulting girls and women, and in particular talking about raping girls. Please check your child's phone and remove them from this group. If I hear, this is the principal obviously speaking, if I hear that such chat is continuing, I will refer the matter to the Gardaí. Thanks for your help in this matter. And the listener writes, it concerned me how it was only going to be addressed by asking the parents to remove their children from the Snapchat group if they are in it. My daughter goes to this school. It upset me and her that she will be mixing with boys that possibly discuss freely about raping and insulting girls. I think it is crucial that something like this is not taken lightly. If these boys don't experience any type of consequence for how they speak about girls and how are girls supposed to feel comfortable, we must not undervalue our girls in schools. Schools must act on this behaviour and not act as if they don't care how girls and women are talked about. It is important that there is mutual respect for one another in schools. This should be the priority given the minute they step inside the school in first year. It should be the first thing that is taught in SBHE class in order to create a group of young individuals that know what language is acceptable to use and what is not acceptable going forward. Now, the reason I'm reading that at this time, Eve, is because of the mention of Snapchat, is because of first years are what, 13, 14, and this woman is making the point, it's not related to your case, obviously, but this woman is making the point that she thinks this should be taken much more seriously than a warning to the parents that if they don't remove themselves from the group, the principals will bring it to the Gardaí. I think what our listener is saying, you should go to the Gardaí now and not wait, because it's very, very difficult for 14-year-olds, and you went through it all in your head. If I go to the Gardaí about this man, my parents will get upset, my step-parent, his family, my family, and I'm not, and he was drilling that into you, of course, and I'm not able for that worry and upset that you felt that you might cause by reporting that you were a victim, which is a terrible, terrible dilemma to be in. But that's the school Snapchat scenario from a listener. What reaction have you got? Your name was used in court. You did waive your anonymity, and you're waiving it here today. But what reaction have you got?
In relation to the email you just received, I think that's a lot more common than is talked about as well.
Is it?
I know from my experience when I was 14 and 15, a lot of people that I hung around with, mm-hmm. they kind of make jokes about sexual assault and things like that, and make jokes about rape, and they'd kind of just do mm-hmm. it without even realising it, just think that they're being funny or it's something to have a laugh about, but they might not think that they're doing anything wrong. But the other side to that then is you could be saying that to a victim of sexual assault who doesn't know if they should come forward or not, and then they hear someone joking about it like that, and that could just be a reason for them not to report it.
It
just takes something so small to say that you don't even think about what effects it will have for a survivor to never mention it again or to never tell anyone about it because of somebody making a joke like that without thinking about the effects that it will have.
And have people said to you, I hope they have, that you were very courageous what you did in terms of reporting it, and two, going public?
Yeah, I've had a lot of support. I've had so many messages from people, many people thanking me for spreading awareness on this and for using my voice. I think that the more it's talked about and the more people are educated about this, the less chance there is for abusers to do this to people. I'm absolutely overwhelmed with the amount of support I've had.
Well, you have a very gentle voice, but a very strong message, a powerful message of what you've of an awful experience, horrific experience that you've been through, Aoife. And I really appreciate you talking for the last half hour on the programme today. I'll give out the National 24-Hour Helpline, by the way, if you've been affected by any of the issues raised, is 1-800-77-8888. That's the Rape Crisis Centre, 1-800-24-Hours, 1-800-77-8888. Aoife Lynch, survivor, stay well, Aoife. You've helped so many people you will probably never, ever get to meet or know, but I think you've helped so many people by being so brave in terms of exposing the crimes that were committed against you. Margaret, your point, you want to say a message. You say, yeah, I have a message for Aoife. Hello, Margaret.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead. You're listening to Aoife.
And first of all, I want to congratulate her on being so brave.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic what she's done. I was in a similar situation to Aoife, like a long time ago. I'm a lot older than Aoife.
Yeah.
As regards, you know, that she was speaking about the years that she's lost in her childhood and her teenage years.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, she's lost them, but she won't get them back, but she's going to gain wonderful years in her future.
Okay.
By her actions in the present.
Yeah.
She really, really is. She's a very strong girl.
Yeah.
Very strong young woman now.
And
thank you so much. I just hope this helps, even if it helps one person, or if one person turns around and opens up to somebody that they trust about it, and it makes the burden a bit easier on them, it would mean the world to me. It's just, as long as this helps people, that's the main thing.
It will, Aoife, but really it's helping you already, and I don't think you realise how much it's helping you at the moment. You know, you're going to have a great present and a fantastic future.
Thank you so much.
Because things will change, Aoife, so much for you. You're going to find a fantastic inner peace, a wonderful inner peace, knowing what you've done for yourself.
And Margaret, are you speaking from experience, can I ask?
I am indeed, Joe. Yeah, I am indeed.
And did your crimes against you, did they come to court?
They went to a civil court
with
a successful conclusion. But unfortunately, the person that abused me sought and received a judicial review, and he avoided the criminal courts.
Wow. And was he, this person that abused Aoife, was in the family circle, so to speak. That's how he had access to her, and that's how he exploited her vulnerability. Was that the same for you?
It was, yes. Yeah. He abused me in my grandmother's home and in my own family home.
And
again, with adults around.
And how did he, Aoife said she was worried about meeting him in the interim. your abuser, from what you say, didn't go to criminal court. It didn't get to the criminal court or whatever. But did you see him in the meantime? Did you? How did he treat you in the meantime? When he knew you were gone.
He was threatening and he was rude, and we met him almost on a daily basis.
Oh my God!
Yeah, he was abusive to my husband and my sons, who were children at the time.
My God!
So much so, we relocated.
You relocated?
Yeah, yeah. It was the best way.
You moved away from the area?
Yeah, totally, to a different county.
My God.
But again, I mean, this is what I'm saying to Aoife. What steps she's taking in her life now is giving her a present and will give her a future. I mean, that's what I got.
Yeah.
By my actions, not only in going to the guards and going to the court system. You become a stronger person because these people take all of your power. It's about power.
Yeah.
They strip you of your power.
But that means if you took a civil action against him, that means you were in a courtroom with him, Margaret.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. How was that experience?
Well, when we entered the courtroom, we sat at the very back of the courtroom as advised by my solicitor.
Okay.
And he chose to sit on the front, to sit right in front of me and turn his whole body and his face into mine and started name-calling me then.
Oh, my God. In front of other people? It doesn't matter whether it's in front of, he did name-call you. But he was that brazen.
I had support from the Red Crisis Centre, and my husband was there, and my sister-in-law, and obviously the solicitor and junior and senior counsel, and he did it.
Okay.
And then when the judge came out, he saw people and obviously recognised and devised themselves who was who. And then he asked, were we all present, and recognised then who he was, and then called him to the front of the court and told him not to move. But when I was called up to give evidence, he continued then with that.
He continued to abuse you?
Yes.
Verbally?
Yep, while I was in the witness box. He didn't have representation himself.
And surely
he was given leave to cross-examine me.
But surely he would have been removed from the court if he was verbally abusing a witness and someone who was in the witness box.
He was asked 3 times to stop, and on the 3rd occasion he did stop. And I had to come back and give evidence after lunch, and he started again, and then he was warned again that he'd be taken down unless he stopped.
My God. And as you say, the Rape Crisis Centre were with you as well as your family. How long did the abuse go on for, Margaret, can I ask?
From the age I was 10 until I was 17. And I had done my leaving at 17 then. As people do at that stage, and possibly are young adults, I said, right, I'm grown up now, I've had enough, I don't have to go down to that house anymore. And I didn't. And then the following year, my grandmother was dying, and I did go down while she was ill. On one of those occasions, I was very upset. And he said, oh, come on in here. And again, he abused me in his bedroom. And afterwards, one night I had my eldest son, he would come up to the house. I'd left work to look after, but went to a second son afterwards to look after my children. And he commented on how, oh, I must be short of money because I had work in the financial sector and had a preferential loan. And obviously the loan went when I left, and as did the wage. He said, oh, you must be short of money now. I'll show you how to make a few bob and no one will know. But I was terrified of him until I did speak out about it. I was age 37 and my mum had died when I spoke about it then.
Just on Margaret, on the money scenario, was he saying he would pay you?
Yeah. Well, he did give me money as a child.
Yeah.
Like £5 was a lot when I was younger, and then I went to 10. And or 50 and 70. Because I remember my sisters and even my cousins saying they often wondered how I always had money for records and Wrangler jeans and sweatshirts when I was young.
Yeah.
And I suppose the strange thing for me is looking back on it, I wonder, I know his sisters and my granny knew, but other adults around never questioned it.
Yeah. And Margaret, when you said those words to Aoife at the start, that what you did, Aoife, was brilliant, and you will find, I know you feel, and you rightly so, that your teenage years were robbed, and obviously that's mirrored in you, who were abused for 7 years, between 10 and 17. But you then said the fact that you gone public and are going public and are speaking out, not just in court but now, will give you that inner peace. Have you found that, Margaret?
Oh, definitely.
Okay,
yeah.
That's good.
Because you become really a different person. You become stronger, and you know who you are. You know what you want in life, the people that are there for you, because the support I've gotten from cousins and from friends, my doctor, you've spoken with him a few times on the radio, Aidan Lackey, Aidan Hampson, he's a fantastic guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, friends around that have been there, they don't question, they listen, they're there for you.
Yeah.
The Rape Crisis Centre.
Yeah.
With the court support services when they were there. Noreen Cohn, she was brilliant.
Yeah.
And all of those people, and they're still there.
Yeah.
You just build up such a network around you, and then with the support of that network, you too become a stronger person. Because, and no matter what, you don't become arrogant or aggressive, but you just become stronger, and no one in life hurts you again.
Yeah. That's such a powerful message.
Yeah, no one will hurt you again, because you become stronger, but you become sensitive too.
Yeah.
And to hear Aoife there, do you know what I mean, speaking like that, and she's such a young person.
Mm.
And the strength and the power that she has. Like, she's speaking to the nation, Joe, today.
Mm. Aoife, before we take a break, do you want to react to Margaret or say anything to Margaret? I want to give the two of you the last word, not me.
I just want to say I'm so sorry that that happened to you, and I'm so grateful for you to coming on air to speak to me, and I only hope that I can have as much courage and strength as you in the future. That should never have happened to you, and fair play to you for being able to go through all that, especially seeing him on a daily basis, because I know if that was me, I would not be able to do that.
Lisa, thank you for your words, and as I said, you're very strong too. You know, you're at the beginning of your journey. I know you're going to get there.
Thank you so much.
You're a great girl, and I wish you the very best.
You as well. I hope everything works out and you get everything you've ever wanted out of life.
And you too, Aoife.
Okay. More people want to talk to you if you're amenable, Aoife, and indeed Margaret, after this break. Joe at RTE.ie.
Thanks, Joe.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
We've been talking to Aoife Lynch. Aoife is 21 years of age, a young woman. She was abused beginning at 14. And Margaret was also in the conversation. Margaret was abused between the age of 10 and 17, but also went to court. They've been talking to each other. I just want to finish, Aoife and Margaret, by thanking you both and reminding people, I think both of you mentioned the great work of the Rape Crisis Centre. I want to give out their number again. It's 1-800-77-8888. Stay well, Aoife Lynch, and look after yourself and the people who, as Margaret pointed out so eloquently, there's many more people around you that will help than sometimes we realise. And I think you discovered that as well, Aoife, after you broke this man's awful hold on you. And Margaret, thanks again for your message as well, Margaret, and stay well and stay safe, and just the messages of support coming in for you both. Thank you both. Thank you, Aoife Lynch, and thank you, Margaret.
Thank you so much for having me and for giving me the opportunity to help spread awareness on this matter.
Yeah, but Aoife, even look, your reaction to Margaret, the first thing you said to Margaret when Margaret told her story was, "Margaret, I'm so sorry for what's happened to you." That was your first reaction, which just shows how connected you are to the feelings and the real feelings that people have. Margaret as well, messages coming in for your telling of the story and sympathy and support, and the fact that you mentioned that point that there's many more people out there that will support you than you sometimes realise, and that it will give you an inner peace, and hopefully Aoife finds that inner peace that you found, Margaret. So thank you, Margaret, as well.
Thank you, Joan. Thanks for the opportunity again. Okay. And the best of luck, Aoife. Hope everything works out for you.
Okay. Aoife, you mind yourself.
Thank you so much.
You're still a very, very young woman with a great voice and incredible courage. Incredible courage. Thanks, Aoife. Thanks, Margaret. It's joe at rt.ie's email. Let me start out another break.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
And Joe at rt.ie. We spoke about this new phenomenon which was brought to our attention last week from different colleges, from different parts of the country, which is groups of young lads from 10 upwards, often on bikes, hanging around together and for some reason egging each other on bravado-wise, and then carrying out assaults or abuse of adults, invariably adults who are on their own. Luke, good afternoon.
How's things?
Good. When did this happen, Luke?
So it happened last Saturday.
Okay.
I was in the city centre in Dublin.
Okay.
And went in to meet one of my friends, and we were getting a bit of food and we were sitting down on steps.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, these gang of young lads, maybe from the age of about 14, 16, I'd say.
Okay.
Came cycling down on the footpath.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one knocked what I was eating out of my hand. The next one swung a kick at me as he flew by, caught me in the face.
Oh, God.
And the next one punched me in the neck.
All from their bikes, Luke.
All from their bikes, yeah. As they passed by, there was about 15 of them. And I think it was 3 of them actually hit me. So, but they were all in their group, you know, all big men when they're outnumbering you.
Yeah.
You know.
And what age are you, Luke?
I'm 21. Yeah. So...
I tried to stand up
for myself, but like when there's numbers of people, like there's not, you know, you're not gonna do too much really.
And it was just, well, first of all, a lot of people are having meeting outdoors because it is only the only place we're allowed to meet, and every restaurant and cafe and pub is closed. So you're sitting outside, and you reckon it was just they're almost like a marauding band of cowboys coming into town. They just sweep down on their bikes and they lash out at whoever happens to be within kicking distance.
Pretty much, yeah. It was completely unprovoked.
Yeah.
Completely random. Me and my friend were just sitting there, and even after, my friend said to me, he was like, I can't even believe that just happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, as someone who's not originally from Dublin, I've never really experienced anything like it, you know?
And
so
it is.
It was eye-opening, really.
So the fourth, did they kick the food out of your hand? Was it all feet? Given that they were on bikes.
Yeah, it was... Well, no, the first lad stuck out his leg and kicked it out of my hand.
Yeah.
And the next lad swung a kick at my face. You know, I wouldn't have minded the food, you know, I would have got on with it. But, you know, that was something I didn't expect. And then the last lad just punched me in the neck as I was standing up. So...
So they knew... If somebody in a group of people kicked someone's food out of the hand, someone in the group would say, "Hang on, what are you up to? You just give it over."
That's the thing.
But in your case, it looked like the domino effect. So they knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
So in other words, they did it before, and they probably did.
Yeah,
it subsequently.
I wouldn't be surprised if they have.
This is their kick. This is their coordinated kick of the 15 of them. Running around on bikes and just for the crack.
Yeah.
Just seeking, one kicks the food out of your hand, the next fella kicks you in the face, the head, I presume. Just,
just the edge of my mouth,
And then the third fella reaches down and gives you a punch as he's flying by.
Yeah.
Were there any Gardaí around, Luke? Or?
Well, luckily, on the day it happened, there was a lot around town.
Yeah.
So I walked away, and me and my friend went around the corner, and luckily there was a guard around. So we told him what happened. We brought him up to the scene, and there was a few people who had seen it happen. So he interviewed everyone, took everyone's names and everything.
Oh,
so,
God.
Yeah. And there was three CCTV cameras. So,
okay.
Yeah.
All right, how are you now, Luke? How are you doing?
I'm okay. Like, it makes me a bit on edge.
Yeah.
You know, when you go into town, because, you know, I have been trying to avoid it, but, like, ultimately, I do work, so I do.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I can't avoid it completely. So, yeah, it's just, it really puts you on edge almost, but at the same time, I'm not going to try let these people you know, get to me and, you know,
well,
bigger than that. Like,
yeah, hopefully they're caught and hopefully try not to over worry. It's an awful thing that's happened to you, but it was so random
that
they didn't come into town looking for Luke. They came into town looking for anybody. And I'd say there was more Lukes that day, Luke, than you, unfortunately.
I'd imagine so.
So thanks for speaking out about it, because as I say, we've had calls last week from adults who were abused by these group of young people. I don't know, are they not in school or what's going on? But Luke, look after yourself and stay safe, and thanks for speaking to us. Thanks,
cheers.
Luke. Thanks. Cheers. Cheers.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Stephen Hutchinson, good afternoon.
How are you doing, Joe?
What did you spot in Longford in January?
I spotted what the physicist said, there's no such thing as a UFO. But I can tell him there is, definitely, what I've seen anyway.
Okay, an unexplained or an unidentified flying object.
Unidentified object, yeah.
What did you see?
Now, to lead up to this, right, my daughter in Mullingar, with the lockdown, and I was wondering how she's going to get on, and with her daughters and all that, because everybody's keeping to themselves. So she rang up and said she got a telescope, a Bresser telescope. And I thought, isn't that fantastic?
In the lockdown, for a hobby?
Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah,
brilliant.
I think it'd be a great thing for young people. So
brilliant.
I was always half interested in myself, but she, the fact that she rang up and said she's after getting one, I was over the moon with that. Because with my son, the two of them are looking out at the moon and said he could see this and that, and God, I was delighted for them, you know, that we might go down to Bear Observatory someday and have a look when it's open again. So with that in my head, a couple of nights after that, it was a beautiful pitch black night, dead still. I just had to go to back. Sometimes I have a cigar out the back, and as my relations would tell me, I love a cigar. And hard to get them now, nearly impossible. But anyway, I stood out the back, looking up at the stars.
Right.
And I could see the plough as clear as anything. Everything was very clear. And all of a sudden, this orange object, now, the way I would describe it is, if you put your arms out and widen them out, we're about a metre in distance.
Okay.
Up in the sky, it was that kind of big. It was probably the size of a football field in relation to size, right? Pure orange. Now, the point was, as I'm always watching the birds in the garden and that, I bought myself a nice pair of binoculars. Myself and the brother, and go walking with the binoculars and that. So I said, isn't it great to have my binoculars here in the kitchen?
Okay.
I ran in to get them. I could see the thing, so to speak, clear, but I couldn't. It was a hazy thing going all across the whole side of it that I couldn't make out anything except this orange cigar-shaped object.
So you're now looking through your binoculars?
I'm looking through, well, I could see it without the binoculars. But
okay.
I thought I'd be able to see. Yeah, I thought I could see things in it, whatever they are in it. But it was haze out like you'd see in a film where they haze out people's faces. The other way it would be glittery, you couldn't make out distinction. So that was going the whole length of the craft. And it was that big. And the funny thing, I said, God, isn't that amazing? It's right at my back door.
Yeah.
Looking out, I'm looking out across the field now where I am. I'm up in Longford, where the rugby club is. and there's a whole open area, nothing blocking me to see.
And
right
what
out.
Was your were you frightened or amazed?
No, I wasn't frightened.
Yeah,
I was amazed that it was part of it. I was amazed that it was up my back garden.
Okay.
The only thing I am annoyed because I had a big phone upstairs, but because I thought the binoculars was going to show me everything I wanted to see, I was so mesmerised without looking at it. But I wasn't. I wasn't a bit afraid. I had seen one before, 40 years ago.
But you didn't take.
You didn't take a photograph. No, I couldn't. But if I know the.
And what do you think was? What do you think was in it, Stephen?
I don't know. There was somebody flying it because what happened was it moved from left to right as I was looking at it, and it stopped completely opposite where I was.
A drone?
Up in the sky. No, it wasn't a drone, no, sir. No, I often had a little drone.
Okay.
I'm used to spotting planes in Abyshul and watching for Cessnas 152s coming over.
Part of the country.
And you'd hear the sound of them, and 172s. I flew 152.
And there was no sound?
No, completely no sound. And a helicopter you'd hear from miles away before it gets to you.
Of course you do, yeah.
But okay, it was pitch black, so nothing flies at night. Like that.
Okay, stay with us. Betty Mitchell is in Birmingham. Betty, what did you see?
Hi, Joe. In 1973-74,
right.
I'm not quite, I can't remember the date at the time, but I was visiting a friend in Birmingham, and it's only about 5 miles from Birmingham Airport. And as I was leaving the house about 10:30 at night, you know, when you come out thinking, oh, it's a lovely night, looking up at the sky. And I said to my friend, it's a beautiful night, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I just seen this red spot, like the end of a cigarette light coming out of the sky. And it came, and it hovered right over the house where we were. Mm-hmm. And honestly, Joe, it was nearly sitting on the roof. It was a big, black machine. Mm-hmm. It was hovering. There was no sound coming out of it.
Mm.
And both my friend and I, we were astonished. And with that, it shot off at such speed. And you just felt you were being observed. Anyway, it shot across, and there was a field at the back of the house. We ran out to the back of the house, nothing. Could see nothing, hear nothing. Mm. Just disappeared immediately. Anyway, a couple of days later, my friend... we were talking. So the next morning, when I came home, I rang Birmingham Observatory.
Yeah.
And I just asked them, you know, told them what happened. And I said, I was just wondering, has anybody else phoned in with any other experiences like this? So they said, no, not that we're aware of, you know. But they just asked me to give them the details, which I did, and left it at that. 2 days later, again talking to my friend, and he said, you know, I seen it again last night.
Okay.
I said, you're joking. No, no. I said, well, why don't you phone up the observatory and report it? And, he said, people will only laugh at me.
Yeah.
And he was in a high position. He didn't want people laughing at him.
Do you think it's extraterrestrial life?
I don't know, Joe. All I can say, you know, Joe, we as human beings, we're not just human beings, we're spiritual beings as well.
Yeah.
And a few years later, and just reading when I was praying one day, and I just came across this reading, and I've heard it, I suppose, many times, but never paid any attention. Ephesians 6, verse 12 says, "Put on all the armor of God and the belt of truth around your waist. For it's not against human enemies that we have to struggle, but with the cosmic wicked spiritual forces in the heavenly realms." Now, you yourself said yesterday, Joe, about, the changing of water into wine and all this.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the Bible is full of stories. And if we're talking about heavenly beings, I think most of us who believe in angels. You know, it's right through the scripture, beginning to end. And the fact, you know, Jesus himself, he ascended into heaven in a cloud. He walked on water. He appeared to Mary Magdalene. Now, were they all mad?
Mm.
You know, and but that reading said to me it was something more than I'd ever thought about spiritual beings. And, do you know, Joe, you've been talking all week about the horror of what happened with the McCann family.
Yeah.
And if that's not evil, what is? That's what I was just thinking.
Okay. So give me that reference again, Betty, from... What book is it from?
Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12. It says it quite plainly.
Okay. Kevin Collier is on the line. Joe at rte.ie, 51551, wash your hands, please. Kevin.
Joe, how are you doing?
You're listening. What do you think of what Betty has just said?
Yeah, there's a good bit of what she said now that I would be in agreement with. She was talking there about Jesus Christ, whom I'm a true believer in, and God the Father, myself. Hmm. But she didn't say that about the evil spirits and about who guides the evil spirits, who's Satan, whom all of you seem to want to forget, but is truly there, present, as he was when he tempted Jesus in the garden for the 40 days and 40 nights, which we're coming up to celebrating.
And what do you think of Betty telling the story of what she saw, and she did believe it was from some other planet or whatever? Some other place.
But you see, Joe, but just to say to you, when you see lights in the sky and you see things in the sky, you can't say that they are coming from another. Well, you can say it if you want. There's no one stopping you from saying it. But to believe that that's actually true. Now, Jesus Christ, our God the Father, didn't say that these, in chapter 6, 12, it didn't say that these were aliens that was coming from another planet and going to take us over. Now, because in the first instance, God put them there. He put them planets there. Right.
And is it compatible with being a Catholic, believing that there may be life out there?
No, personally, I don't think so, because you have to think of all these. You have to think of all these other things that's happening as Satan driven. No, you can see things.
Yeah, but
and things, evil things, and all that happen, and people, things can appear like they did all through the years, but guided by Satan.
Kevin.
Go on, sorry.
Excuse me, Joe.
First of all, Kevin, Betty, weren't you married to a Catholic, to a ministering Catholic priest?
To a Catholic priest, and we went.
And he was a Catholic priest till the day he died. And you were man and wife for many years. Do you mind me?
We were man and wife for 36 years. Now, Joe.
So there's a fair chance, Kevin, that Betty, who was married to a Catholic priest, knows a fair bit about religion. Do you accept that, Kevin?
You see, I would say she knows a fair bit about religion. But it's what the things, another word, one thing anyway for sure, being married to a Catholic priest doesn't give you any authority over anybody else as to how much you know about the script. You see, it's not the point of knowing the scriptures and that or what's happening. You've got to believe it. No, you have to believe in God and Jesus Christ especially, or for that there's no way into heaven. And there's things happening out there and so many evil things and that going on. And of course, Satan is the one. He's the only other power apart from Jesus, apart from Jesus Christ. Yeah. Okay. Betty wants to say something.
Yeah,
I think, does
Betty,
he?
Yeah.
Excuse me, Joe.
Yes, Betty.
What I'm talking about is, I do believe in the devil. I do believe in evil. I mean, you know what you were talking about all this week. Now people are. How they come to the point of doing such dreadful things. If that's not evil, as I said before, I don't know what to say. Now, we are talking about, I don't know whether it was a real UFO, whether it was some cosmic power that in the heavenly realms, which the scripture talks about, and Jesus was full of the scripture. All I know is you said about the things Jesus did, also about the apparitions in different places all over the world, all these people. And, you know, Our Lady, when she appeared to Bernadette at Lourdes, she told Bernadette to go and tell the bishop. Bernadette went to the bishop and told him, and he didn't believe her. And what did Bernadette say? Our Lady, she said, Our Lady told me to tell you, not to convince you. You can't convince anybody whether God exists or not.
But Kevin,
about this dreadful world, Joe.
Betty, if I'm paraphrasing Kevin correctly, and correct me if I'm right, Kevin, or wrong, Kevin. What Kevin is saying is that this is through no fault of your own. The sightings of these UFOs, it's the work of Satan. Is that fair, Kevin?
That's fair. Yeah.
Okay.
Fair enough. Yeah.
So, are you saying Satan has channeled his?
Satan. There's highly intelligent men have been looking into it.
Yeah.
I am not saying it's Satan. I believe it was in the end when I read that reading, because it immediately brought to mind what I witnessed that night. I'd no account for it. I didn't see any human being. I didn't see any faces. I saw a big, black, heavy machine as big as a tank. And there was no windows. There was nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Okay.
Only black
Joe,
metal.
Joe, can I,
very,
sorry.
Not Chinese.
Sorry,
yes.
Can I just ask Betty a question?
Yeah.
Does Betty truly believe that God made the world and everything in it?
Of course I do, and that's exactly what I'm going to say next.
Hmm.
Right.
There's evil in the world. The world is not... Everybody says, oh, aren't we living in a terrible world? I don't believe that. We are living with a terrible evil that affects all of us, and it only comes... And you can laugh, you can joke, people can scoff as much as they like. It's called original sin. Look what happened in the church. Where did that come from?
And Kevin, do you take your guidance from the Catholic Church, the institution, or the Bibles?
I take it from the Scripture and from my true belief in the Lord Jesus Christ and God the Father. That's where I take it from.
Does that include the Catholic Church, the teachings of the Pope?
Oh, I don't always go with what the Pope says. No, I don't. I'm a Catholic. Mm. But I don't always go with what the Pope says. If the Pope says something that doesn't agree with Scripture or doesn't fit in that line, like, I won't follow that. I don't have to follow it like that's the thing. The biggest thing that I have to do in this world, and everybody else should be doing as well, is to genuinely and truly believe in Jesus Christ. Or otherwise, no matter what they do, they're not going to heaven. Like that's the thing, and that's where our aim is to get to heaven. But if they don't truly believe in Jesus, and therefore,
well,
Satan is in the world. He tempted Jesus.
Okay, forgive Betty, forgive me for using you in this question. But Kevin, given that the Catholic Church does not allow priests to get married, and Betty was married to a priest who still said Mass. Is she within or without the Catholic Church?
Oh, she wouldn't be. Oh, as far as I'd be concerned, she'd be out. You know, and the other thing...
Why is she out?
Because it's not right to be married to the priest. Like, that's the thing. He's not meant to be married. He's a man, all right, and he's for looking after...
But he was married, and he was married within the eyes of the Catholic Church, wasn't he, Betty?
Peter was married. Jesus called married men.
Yeah.
They left thing and follow Jesus.
But Peter said Mass legitimately, whatever, I hate using that word.
I mean, I don't pay it.
After he married you, isn't that correct, Betty? He had his own parish and everything.
Yeah, of course.
In the Catholic Church. Yes.
Excuse me, Joe, please listen. And the gentleman talking.
Okay, I need... Yeah.
I am listening, Betty.
Yeah, right,
you listen to me
and not
them.
If you go back at the history of the whole of the history
okay,
of the...
You,
Married priests only came in the 4th century.
Okay, I haven't got time, Betty, unfortunately. Yes, but
oh, I know you.
Yeah, but the point is that, Betty, you were legitimately and openly and correctly married to a Catholic priest who was still ministering.
I was. And we went,
yes.
And carried on his ministry in the Church of England.
Okay, okay.
And we were Church of Ireland. And really,
okay.
Joe,
okay,
we're all
sorry, Joe.
Okay, Kevin, I got to go. I'm so sorry.
Okay.
I'm way over time. We'll
call back again.
We will.
Bye,
okay,
bye, Betty.
Thanks indeed, and I'll explain tomorrow how Betty was married to a Catholic priest. I have to take a quick break.
Bye.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Lisa Marie Berry, producer Ray Darcy next.